Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the use of religious exemptions when it comes to vaccines for children is up 90% in Illinois in the past decade. What's behind the increase and what might change the trajectory? Bird flu is a big problem for poultry farmers. It's also a concern for wild birds, and many of them are dying from it. We'll hear about cuts to a federal agency that helps with rural economic development and what that could mean for areas that rely on its work. Cuts to weather agencies is having an impact on students who want to enter that field. We'll also have a report on how Illinois is handling changes from the Trump administration in comparison to another state, Florida. Students at SIU Carbondale's Fermentation Science Institute can get hands-on experience working in a brewery. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Texas is experiencing its largest measles outbreak in 30 years. Here in Illinois, religious exemptions to vaccines is up 90% in the past decade. Peter Medlin spoke with a religious studies professor about the growth of those exemptions.
Last year, more than 25,000 Illinois students from both public and private schools received a religious exemption for the measles vaccine. That's up about 90% from a decade before, according to data from the Illinois State Board of Education. Other states, like Texas, allow for exemptions based on a, quote, reason of conscience, like a religious belief. Those exemptions led to lower vaccination rates in Gaines County, where the measles outbreak began and spread among the county's Mennonite Christian community. In Illinois, religious exemptions are the only non-medical exemption families can seek. And back in 2015, Illinois made it more difficult to receive religious exemptions. The state passed a law that made parents and guardians submit an exemption form that both details the, quote, specific religious beliefs that conflict with immunization and requires them to get the form signed by the child's health care provider. It's then up to the school to decide if the objection is valid or not. It's probably not a surprise that the Illinois schools with the most religious exemptions are religious schools, and many of those schools have seen significant increases in the percentage of students who received exemptions. A private Christian school in suburban Cook County had the most objections last year. In the past 5 years, they've gone from 11% to 30% of their students receiving them, and others have gone from 10% to 25% or 1% to 10% in that same time span. And it's important to note that, as those numbers indicate, it's still a minority of families at these schools who are seeking these waivers. But why exactly are they seeking them so much more now as opposed to 5 or 10 years ago? Max Perry Mueller is an associate professor of religious studies and history at the University of Nebraska, and he says, just think about what's happened in the last 5 years.
I do think COVID is the obvious and clear catalyst to the increase in these exemptions.
But COVID doesn't explain everything. For one, Mueller says it doesn't explain why the politicization of the COVID vaccine would spill over into denial of other vaccines like MMR for measles.
COVID was the catalyst that drove up exemptions, but it was a movement within these communities, especially on the religious right, the evangelical religious right, of skepticism, if not hostility to institutions and their expertise, especially bureaucratic expertise.
Mueller says that distrust of government institutions and, by extension, public schools had been building since Reagan and the so-called moral majority. Then COVID became a perfect catalyst to weave mistrust of vaccines more clearly into the worldview that the government exerts too much control over their lives and the lives of their children. But the religious exemption form families submit does ask people to detail specific religious beliefs that conflict with immunization. Is there a particular set of Bible verses commonly cited by those seeking an exemption? Well, a 2021 post from the Christian think tank The Family Research Council outlines how families can justify religious exemptions by citing a verse from the book of Romans that says, quote, "For whatever does not proceed from faith is sin." So Christians shouldn't willfully act against their conscience. Mueller says this is an example of what theologians call proof texting.
The Bible is such a complex text that you can make it say anything you want, and people have for millennia.
But Mueller says that's not to say these anti-vaccine beliefs are insincere.
These folks are coming from a genuine place of care for their children. They think that they're doing what's best for their children.
And again, this is still a minority view. Most people do see the value of vaccines. But Mueller doesn't think anti-vaccine sentiment is a short-term COVID-era phenomenon either. He thinks this is a generational shift that was a long time coming. And Mueller thinks there's only one thing that could change that.
And what will change it, and I do believe eventually it will change, is unfortunately mass outbreaks and mass suffering. And when a lot of these same families find that their children and the children in their communities are suffering horribly from these communicable diseases.
When measles vaccination rates dip below 95% in a community, that's when the risk of an outbreak begins to climb. In Gaines County, Texas, where the current outbreak started, the measles vaccination rate was 82%. In Illinois, there are only two counties, both at the southern tip of the state, with rates below 90%. I'm Peter Mudlin.
The bird flu epidemic has had a major impact on the poultry industry and is also taking the lives of a majestic bird that's made parts of northern Indiana a popular landing spot. Michael Puente has more.
Sean Leone got up before the crack of dawn last month to see a rare sight right outside of his house. That's the sound of thousands of sandhill cranes on a sheet of ice on Fish Lake in northern Indiana, just east of LaPorte. Sandhill cranes are tall with gray bodies with a hint of crimson on their face.
There they go, taking a flight. All the sandhill cranes heading up. There's thousands of them.
The cranes' annual visits are one of Leone's favorite parts of living on Fish Lake, but about a week after he shot this video, Leone noticed something troubling.
Well, I started making the phone calls to DNR on February 16th, and then after about 3-4 days later, I started seeing more dying, and then I called them again.
A few turned into dozens. Many of the fallen birds could be seen on the frozen ice sheet, some floating to the shore or winding up in the grassy brush.
This is the first time I've ever seen sand cranes ever wash up on shore. We estimated between 125 to 150 range that died on our lakes.
As of Friday, there were 1,957 sandhill cranes reported as dead.
That's Eli Fleece, fish and wildlife biologist with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources.
Because this is just based off of the reports that we get. So if, you know, a crane dies out in the woods somewhere and nobody sees it, we don't get that one reported.
Fleece says what's causing the deaths is bird flu, also known as avian influenza, the same virus that's killing tens of thousands of chickens throughout the country. It's obviously not the first outbreak of bird flu, but Flea says it's the first time the virus has felled sandhill cranes.
The past years, I have not seen avian influenza affect the sandhills at all. But my theory is that the virus may have mutated this past year. And so now it's more able to infect sandhill cranes than it was previously.
Back at Fish Lake, Leone says it's hard watching these majestic birds succumb to an illness.
They would stand like a statue for several days, and then they would separate from the pack, you know, about house length or more, and then they would circle around in circles for about an hour or more, and then they would drop. And I watched 45 of them die out my window being on the lake. So
that's got to be sad.
It was hard to watch all the animals just randomly dying for no reason, and especially the number amount of them.
But what happens to all those dead birds? The Indiana DNR doesn't have the resources to pick them up. Leone's been collecting as many dead sandhill cranes as possible off the Fish Lake shoreline, taking every precaution.
Well, being there were so many of them, I was concerned what would happen to our waters. And then also, you know, animals, cats, dogs, and, you know, try to contain it as best as possible. Once I knew I was safe, and I asked some volunteers and asked for donations of bags and gloves and masks and whoever wanted to help out, and kind of went from there.
Leone and his group of about five volunteers have collected 123 sandhill cranes, each weighing about 30 pounds when wet and taking up an entire garbage bag. The DNR predicts the deaths of sandhill cranes will stop once the warmer weather arrives and the virus dies off as well. Michael Puente, WBEZ News.
It's been a turbulent couple of months at the federal agency that funnels funding to many rural communities. USDA Rural Development experienced hundreds of layoffs, then had employees called back. And as Frank Morris reports, that uncertainty may erode a major source of federal largesse for many small towns and farms.
Raising big animals for meat is tough, and on small farms, owners do all the work.
It's not a job that you can just shut on and off. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job, and you really have to be passionate about it to do it.
Janet Batchelder and her husband Brad and 4 kids raise cattle, pigs, bison, and poultry near Belton, Missouri.
This winter has been a hard one, and sometimes you question your life choices when it's negative 25 wind chill. Yeah, checking calves, cutting ice, making sure that everyone's warm, you know.
They've had this farm for a decade, spent most of that time living with their 4 kids in a walled-off, furnished section of the barn. When the pandemic hit and shut down big meatpacking plants, they saw an opportunity to sell individual cuts of meat. But going from raising livestock to also processing it and marketing it is a big step.
We kind of didn't know if we should go to that next level of shipping, marketing, restaurants, butcher shops, and how do you get there?
Brad Batchelder says a grant from USDA Rural Development made it possible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was really almost life-changing for us. This grant has definitely, like, we see a path and a vision now, and that has been even more motivating to us, I think.
Pork is in here. We have our beef products in this freezer.
Now they're running a thriving meat shop out of a corner of the barn where they used to live. USDA Rural Development covers half their processing costs. That investment flows through the rural economy to local butchers and other suppliers. USDA Rural Development is rooted in the Great Depression. It's Washington's primary tool to boost rural areas, places where President Trump won, on average, almost 2/3 of the vote last year. But Kyle Wilkins, who ran USDA Rural Development in Missouri under President Biden, says the agency is in turmoil.
Because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
The Trump administration first pressed USDA Rural Development employees to retire, then terminated hundreds. Now, courts are forcing the agency to rehire workers with back pay, at least temporarily.
Think of the time that you're taken away from these folks doing their actual job, and that is money. It's all it is. It's money.
Congress cut USDA Rural Development by hundreds of millions of dollars last year, a huge problem for farm country, because USDA Rural Development does things that local governments can't afford, building water systems that cost millions for small, shrinking towns, for instance, shoring up hospitals, buying police cars.
In a lot of these communities, USDA Rural Development is the most important partner.
That includes manufacturers that Trump is counting on to boost U.S. industrial production. There's Kyle Wilkins again, standing outside a cabinet factory in Excelsior Springs, Missouri.
That is a huge industrial building that they're making cabinets in, and half of it, which I'd say at least half a football field, is covered in solar panels.
USDA covered half the cost of the enormous solar array topping this building, $250,000.
And right now, almost every small community in Missouri can use that economic goosing, that little bit of help.
Farm state politicians will work to shore up the agency that's done so much for their constituents over the decades. But Wilkins says it'll take time to heal the damage recently inflicted on USDA Rural Development. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Frank Morris.
The Trump administration has threatened to pull funding from Northwestern if the university doesn't do more to protect Jewish students. Now Northwestern is requiring students to complete a new training about anti-Semitism, but some faculty and students say it leaves no room for criticism of Israel and that it will chill free speech. Lisa Curry and Philip has more.
The training is a video that all students are required to watch. In one of the most contentious parts, the narrator suggests comments being made by critics of Israel are the same as statements made by the infamous KKK leader, David Duke.
The fact that you can't tell the difference is terrifying.
Professor Beth Shackman Hurd says she's never seen anything like it in her 24 years at Northwestern. She says the video's implication that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic goes against everything the university stands for, like open discourse and debate.
The imposition of one particular set of views about Israel onto our students And the suggestion that those who disagree or dissent, whether Jewish or non-Jewish, whether on religious grounds or political grounds, are to be silenced, are to be cast out of the community, are to be considered anti-Semitic. That is what's frightening.
Shachman Hurd is one of several faculty and students calling on Northwestern officials to retract the training. But she says university leaders probably won't because they're under the axe of the Trump administration. Northwestern is at the center of multiple federal investigations over its alleged failure to combat anti-Semitism. The stakes were upped last week when the White House announced $400 million in funding cuts to Columbia University over similar allegations.
The fear of being targeted as an example of what happens to you as a university if you don't comply with our political agenda. We will punish you. We will derail you as an institution. We will destroy you. The fear of that happening to Northwestern is very real.
Northwestern President Michael Schill denied a request for an interview. A spokesperson says the training was meant to help the campus community understand how Jewish students feel when they hear certain words and actions. Michael Simon leads the Jewish student organization Northwestern Hillel. He says he hasn't seen all of the video, but he thinks students should have a baseline for confronting anti-Semitism.
I look at these trainings not as an endpoint, but I hope that they'll be a starting point to enabling there to be a more broad and a more thoughtful conversation about these issues in all quarters of the university.
But some students, like senior Isabel Butera, are boycotting the training because they don't want to endorse its contents. Butera is a member of Jewish Voices for Peace, and she says refusing the training feels like a scary thing to do in this moment, especially for international students. Last weekend, federal immigration authorities detained and attempted to deport Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil over his pro-Palestinian activism.
The threat is very real. It is very palpable.
Butera understands Northwestern is in a challenging position, but she says trying to appease Trump will not get the school out from under his thumb. She says Columbia tried that strategy by ramping up disciplinary actions against pro-Palestinian activists.
And it still had its funding frozen. And so I think that this is a moment where I would like to see from my academic institution, as well as others, some resistance and some strength in the face of what is starting as an attack on pro-Palestine speech.
But is going to continue as an attack on academia as a whole, she says. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
Illinois Wesleyan University is also among the universities who are part of the ongoing investigation. You're listening to Statewide. We'll be back in a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. An estimated 800 employees were fired from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration on February 27th. Experts warn it could have major impacts on weather reporting and climate research. And for those students who want to study in that field, it's led to more uncertainty. From the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Harshan Ratanpal reports.
A handful of students are donning black goggles as they step into the cave. That's CAVE, a computer-assisted virtual environment, and they're wearing virtual reality glasses. The students are participating in an interactive storm simulation. Their professor is taking them on a virtual trip through the atmosphere along color-coded conveyor belts carrying warm and cold air, creating clouds, wind, and rain.
And if you look up, you can see...
It's not what class looks like every day, but for these students, it's a welcome change of pace. It was just a few days ago that hundreds of federal employees in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration were fired.
I'm heartbroken.
That's MJ Slutter, a junior studying meteorology. Like many students, she's worried that her career plans to join the federal weather workforce have been ruined.
I'm not really certain what I'm supposed to do now.
Since taking office in January, President Donald Trump's administration has fired thousands of federal employees, including an estimated 6% of NOAA's workforce. One of its primary functions is forecasting weather through the National Weather Service.
I think that's going to be a huge problem when we get active severe weather events that come through the country and National Weather Service offices are not staffed enough to provide those important warnings and weather information to the public.
That's Eric Aldrich, Slutter's professor. The morning after the news broke, he had a 10 a.m. class with upper-level atmospheric science students.
there were a lot of students that were like, well, why should I even continue down this road? My hopes and dreams of working to help save lives and property has just been thrown out the window.
Sophomore Tyler Bucker has wanted to work at the National Weather Service since he was 7. Now he's not sure if that will be possible.
I think my plan as of right now is to just stay in school. I've planned on getting my master's anyways and been thinking about PhD after that. Initially, I was going to, if I could, go into the National Weather Service after my master's.
Many students are thinking about their backup plans, such as focusing on their minor or getting certificates to diversify their skill set. That was the advice given by Patrick Market, the director of the MU School of Natural Resources. He urged students to continue their studies, but sees they're filled with apprehension and disappointment.
The National Weather Service is today, anyway, a primary employer of atmospheric scientists.
At least one current MU graduate student was fired from a Missouri NOAA office. They didn't want to talk to KBIA and say they're still processing the news.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1...
Back in the cave, the simulation is ending, and Aldrich asked the students how they would rate it. They say seeing the 2D models from the classroom come to life in a 3D projection helps better understand them. The cave and other virtual reality projects are used by multiple departments at MU. One research team is using VR to teach cybersecurity to people with neurodevelopmental differences, such as autism. Many of these projects, including the cave, are funded through National Science Foundation grants. Because of federal funding shifts and university budget cuts, both the students and these grants now see clouds on the horizon.
You guys can step on out.
I'm Harshon Rattenpaul.
A look at Florida and Illinois shows how legislatures in the country's often polarized state politics are responding to the Trump administration. States hold a lot of power over what gets done. Here's NPR's Aisha Roscoe.
For weeks now, the news has been dominated by President Donald Trump's executive orders and the big changes he's trying to make. But there are a lot of changes the president can't make at the federal level. On a whole host of issues, President Trump needs help from state governments to enact change. And we're going to look at two states with two different approaches, Florida and Illinois. NPR's Larry Kaplow, an editor with our state's team, is here to get us started. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Aisha.
So what role do states play in helping or hindering a president's agenda?
Right. Well, state powers were really baked into the U.S. Constitution from the beginning, and we're seeing how they exercise those powers now. Take Trump's call for mass deportations. There aren't enough federal agents to carry those out in the numbers that he's seeking. They need help from sheriffs and police departments, but the federal government can't order local law enforcement to do that. State governments, though, and governors can pass laws that compel local law enforcement to assist in things like detentions and immigration enforcement. And they can pass laws that ban cities from having sanctuary laws that limit what local law enforcement can do to assist federal agents. We're also seeing Democratic states pass laws that protect cities' sanctuary laws. I'll point out that most state legislatures are controlled by one party or the other, and they're going in those different directions.
And we're going to hear from a couple of states now, starting with Mawa Iqbal of Illinois from member station WBEZ.
In Illinois, lawmakers haven't been shy about their disdain for President Donald Trump. During a budget address last month, Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker compared Trump's recent executive orders to the end of democracy in pre-war Germany.
The seed that grew into a dictatorship in Europe a lifetime ago didn't arrive overnight. It started with everyday Germans mad about inflation and looking for someone to blame. I'm watching with a foreboding dread what is happening in our country right now.
In the legislature, Democrats have passed resolutions condemning the Trump White House for rolling back DEI measures and for pardoning those connected to the January 6th riots. Republicans walked out of one raucous session, and Democratic House Speaker Chris Welch blasted them.
They should be here to speak out against fascism. We cannot be silent. We must rise up. Speak up. Speak out.
The resolutions are symbolic. But Democrats are planning to spend more money on DEI initiatives in education, even though Trump has threatened federal funding cuts. They're looking to strengthen sanctuary policies and even to fund a healthcare program for adults and seniors without legal status in the U.S. Stephen Schwinn is a constitutional law professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and he says these are areas where states can really assert themselves.
Protecting rights in state law and in the state constitution, as Illinois has done, those are the right moves for legislators and public officials who oppose Trump policies.
Trump lost Illinois by over 11 percentage points, and Democrats have a supermajority in the legislature. That's in contrast to nearby, more evenly split states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan, where lawmakers and some governors have been more cautious about taking on Trump policies, or even favored them. In Illinois, the Republicans are in the superminority and say the state's budget is already headed to a $3 billion deficit because of Democratic spending. State Representative Blaine Wilhauer called their DEI initiatives in schools Marxist ideology.
It's fueled division, punished excellence, and weakened our schools. And now the people in charge of our education system, unelected bureaucrats, think they can just ignore this directive. They think that they can just do whatever they want. We'll see. Paging President Trump, we have a problem in Illinois.
And now we turn to my colleague Regan McCarthy in the Capitol building in Tallahassee for what's happening in Florida.
The busy legislative session is just getting underway here, where we're not far from the big body of water the state's Republican lawmakers are no longer calling the Gulf of Mexico.
The name has changed. It's now the Gulf of America.
Republican State Senator Joe Gruters is behind a bill he says will align Florida with an executive order from the Trump administration by renaming the Gulf in state law and in future materials purchased by schools.
Listen, we want our kids to have the correct names of everything moving forward, and so this is just a way to do that.
That's just one of the bills Florida's Republican-controlled legislature has brought up recently as political players jockey to show their support and loyalty to President Donald Trump and his administration's agenda. There's also a measure to pave the way for Trump to build a presidential library in the state. Another bill would block local governments from adding fluoride to public water, something Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. previously pushed for. Then there's legislation recently passed in Florida to crack down on illegal immigration.
This bill was always from the get-go to work with the president, President Trump, his executive orders, to push his agenda. At the end of the day, he deserves credit for all of this.
That's Gruters again, a longtime supporter of Trump, something Republican State Senator Randy Fine says can pay off in Florida.
Now, I showed tonight what loyalty to Donald Trump meant.
Senator Fine is running with the president's support in a special election for the congressional seat left open when Trump tapped then-Representative Mike Waltz to be his national security advisor. Fine made his statement to his colleagues on the Senate floor just after winning the Republican primary for the seat. He's widely expected to clinch the special election in April.
My reward for that loyalty is I'm going to Congress.
Trump's endorsement weighs heavily in the state, but certainly not for every Floridian. Earlier this year, hundreds of people gathered at the state capitol shouting and waving signs to protest the president and his administration. Among them was 19-year-old Florida State University student Madeline Probst. She disagrees with the president's recent executive orders.
Yeah, I'm hoping he gets impeached for the unconstitutionality of his actions. But if I do have to do this for 4 years, so be it.
Democrats have pushed back against Florida's Republican supermajority, saying time during the state's 60-day session would be better spent on issues like housing costs and skyrocketing property insurance rates.
That was Regan McCarthy of member station WFSU and Mawa Iqbal of WBZ. And Larry Kaplow of NPR's States team is still with us. Larry, two very different ends of the spectrum there from Florida and Illinois. Is that typical?
It really is. In the South, you've got Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, others doing what Florida's doing. On the Democratic side, like Illinois, you have Connecticut, Maryland, California taking staunchly different Democratic approaches. And as we heard, people in some of these states are speaking up for themselves, going to state capitals and protesting on the direction they want to see.
That's NPR's Larry Kaplow. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Southern Illinois University Edwardsville administrators have proposed eliminating the physics major and minor. This comes as part of the university working to erase a $10 million budget deficit. At a campus forum this week, the university heard largely critical feedback on the plan, which would keep core physics classes needed for other science and engineering majors. It would also roll physics into the chemistry department and permanently eliminate five faculty positions over the next couple of years. Eric Voss is chair of the chemistry department, and he says morale might be low right now, but he's hoping university leaders will be receptive.
I have confidence. I'm a half-full person, glass-half-full type of person, so I have confidence that we'll be able to communicate, and hopefully they'll listen to some of our concerns and address them.
SIUE administrators say they could make a final decision this summer. A lot of betting takes place during March Madness, and while it's a fun hobby for many, health experts are worried about those developing problems. Benjamin Thorpe with Side Effects Public Media reports.
Gambling addiction has long been linked to an increased risk of suicide, and some early research, not yet peer-reviewed, points to an uptick in both debt and bankruptcy linked to a state's legalization of sports betting. Some worry that the flood of TV ads and the ease of placing bets on a mobile app, around the clock, has changed how addictive sports betting can be, and how easily people can develop a problem.
In fact, the artificial intelligence-generated micro bets and parlays that allow someone to place literally thousands of potential bets on a single contest is really a big part of the problem.
That's Mark Gottlieb. He leads the Public Health Advocacy Institute at Northwestern University School of Law. The institute sued the online sports betting company, DraftKings, 2 years ago, accusing it of deceptive marketing practices. Gottlieb says many of the supports for problem gambling come after someone has already developed a problem.
We're offering them aid and trying to rescue them with counseling, but rather putting up guardrails to prevent that from happening.
But sports betting industry insiders told Side Effects that they comply with state and federal laws. They say that legalized sports betting is safer than unregulated markets. They also point to statistics from the National Council on Problem Gambling that show just 1% of gamblers have a serious problem, but that's 2.5 million people. And Mark Potenza, a professor of psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine, says those numbers don't capture the entire problem. That's because only a fraction of people will ever seek help.
So oftentimes it may go undetected and it may impact functioning in multiple domains, work, finances, relationships. Often it takes for things to get particularly bad for people to seek help.
And just to be clear, most people who play sports bets in the U.S. have fun, maybe earn a little, lose a little, without developing any problems. But several states have seen an uptick in calls to problem gambling lines, including Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Potenza believes that the ability to bet not just on the result of the game, but on lots of little events, like which player will make the first basket, poses a particularly dangerous problem.
Where do we draw the line or the balance between permitting individual liberties versus promoting public health? And that may involve restricting some of the liberties, particularly with respect to protecting vulnerable populations.
Vulnerable groups like adolescents and young adults, he says. There are concerns that younger people are engaging in sports betting. That worries public health experts because up to 5% of adolescents and young adults who gamble develop a disorder. Here's Mary Lay. She's with the Indiana Problem Gambling Awareness Program.
Because a lot of people don't realize, think about it as being gambling. It's just kind of a fun thing you do on your phone, like playing a game.
And it's the gamification that worries many public health experts. Lay says video game addiction may be connected with gambling addiction. She points out that things like mystery purchases in video games with randomized rewards, called loot boxes, often have an element of gambling to them. But Lay says she hasn't seen a major uptick in calls in Indiana just yet.
We've only been doing this for 5 years now. Sports gaming only began in Indiana in 2019. So I think we'll start to see how that is impacting hotline usage.
Research about the impacts of sports betting is still in the early stages, but concerns have already led to scrutiny at the federal level. Lawmakers are considering further regulations, which would limit gambling ads during sports broadcasts and require affordability checks on gamblers making large numbers of bets. I'm Ben Thorpe, SideFX Public Media.
If you or your loved one is struggling with problem gambling, you can reach the National Problem Gambling Hotline at 1-800-GAMBLER. More ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Southern Illinois University Fermentation Science Institute launched a little more than a decade ago. Since that time, the program has not only taught the science of brewing beer and winemaking, but it's taught students about yeast and food production and even biomanufacturing. Students need to complete a hands-on field experience in order to complete the program. This is the first semester of working with St. Nicholas Brewing in DuCoin to provide a co-op program for students. Brian Sapp visited to find out more.
Really proud of one of the biggest responsibilities of Brew Day for JT is to pull the spent grain out of the mash tun, which is pretty heavy. We normally put
Carl Bundy is the head brewer at St. Nicholas in DuCoin. His passion for brewing started as a home brewer, and now he's brewing several hundred gallons of beer a week. He's sharing his passion and knowledge with SIU senior JT Heiss. Heiss is the first student to take part in the new co-op program. He started in January and is already putting his learning from SIU to use.
Honestly, one of my favorite parts is, like he said, scraping up the spent grain, just because, you know, it provides that physical connection to the process that you just can't really get in the classroom or even really back in the laboratory.
The co-op seemed like a natural fit for Bundy. To him, brewing and serving beer is a celebration of community.
So it really kind of started realizing that, you know, St. Nicholas and SIU Fermentation is in the same neighborhood, you know. DuCoin is 30 minutes from the college, and of course our brew pub down in Murfreesboro is 5 minutes from the college. And realizing that they're now doing a full-blown fermentation program, it only made sense that, you know, we kind of partner together and do something local. You know?
Matt McCarroll is the director of the Fermentation Science Institute. He says the collaboration with St. Nicholas will help not just the program, but students studying in the program.
You know, most of our students, you know, they need to work jobs to have enough revenue to continue going through school, and we're trying to align that so that they can actually work in their field so they gain that experience and knowledge and connections and networking within that field rather than working at a completely unrelated job that they have to take.
Needless to say, JT was on board.
Well, I was initially approached by Dr. McCarroll at the Fermentation Science Program about it after I'd heard that an internship would be required for completion of the degree, and I figured I should try to knock that out as soon as possible. So when he mentioned that they were partnering up with St. Nick's, I immediately jumped at the chance.
Now that the program is up to speed, Bundy sees much better how the program can help students get experience that will help them be successful in the future.
Learning those primary tasks is only going to help him, you know, whenever he starts his career after the program. You know, if he can walk into a brewery, whether it be Seven Barrel or however big it is, go, I have experience crushing grain. I have experience on brew day, knowing when, you know, to recirculate or clean out the spent grain. Those are the kind of all the stepping stones of whenever you start your career as a brewer, the things that you start doing. JT is really inquisitive. He really likes to know the reason why things happen. And that's a good question to ask, because sometimes as trainers, we just train and, you know, we just do it because we do it. But JT always asks the in-depth questions and really challenges me, like, why do we do this? This is why we do this. So I have to, you know, back that up with information and numbers and really kind of explain the process to him.
JT's been excited to jump in, get to work, and experience the beer making process on a larger scale.
You get to see the magic happen. You get to watch the whole grain bed transform into the water, unfermented beer. And then from there, you can actually, you know, watch it take hold and take shape into this thing that, you know, a lot of people are going to enjoy.
According to McCarroll, this hands-on work helps students better understand what they learn in their classes at SIU.
We want to develop a system in our program where our students are known at the national level as being capable employees that are desirable. And the way we do that is making sure we get the program, we give them skill sets here, but also the practical knowledge they get and the networking they get from working in the industry. And we see this as a really good tool for helping us achieve that.
So far, Bundy is glad to see the partnership taking place and helping students grow.
It really excites me and makes me feel accomplished to not only help him start his journey, but that we can talk about these things. We can talk about process. We can talk about beers. We can talk about meads. He was teaching me about mead before you walked in the door. Just kind of that beer community that we're creating here in Southern Illinois.
And as for JT, it seems that he's taking this learning to heart.
I want to figure out more about the lifestyle itself, not just how to clock in, clock out, that sort of thing. I want to be able to know what's happening in front of me at any part of the process and be able to rectify any problems that might arise moving forward.
With the success of this first co-op, McCarroll hopes they will be able to offer more opportunities to students in the future. I'm Brian Sapp.
University of Illinois students at the Urbana-Champaign campus are calling for better housing and meal options during breaks. Adeline Moy with Illinois Public Media reports.
On the desk in her dorm room, Pari Kulkarni has a small, navy blue pot. It used to hold a bamboo plant, a gift from her mom, which she says signifies growth over the years.
But as you can see, like over the winter break, it sort of wilted and dried. I tried saving it, but I could not, unfortunately. So sometime later, maybe.
Like the other nearly 5,000 international undergrads at U of I, Kulkarni has to decide whether to stay on campus or make the long trip back home during her breaks. Currently, U of I offers housing during fall, winter, and spring breaks for $40 a night. During breaks, meals are not available through the university dining halls. Kulkarni is a freshman in computer science. She lives at Pennsylvania Avenue Residence Hall in Urbana and is an international student from India. During fall break, she decided to stay with friends in an off-campus hotel. She says it was easier and cost less to not use university break housing.
So, like, the total cost is around, if you assume, is like $850 to $900, like, if you assume everything, like, together. And for us, our off-campus housing was $800, including free breakfast option.
The hotel was also more conveniently located near grocery stores, whereas living at her dorm would have meant sourcing meals from nearby restaurants, some of which have reduced hours during campus breaks. The MTD bus service is also reduced during breaks, making it more difficult to get around. And, Kulkarni says, the lack of people around campus can affect students' well-being.
Campus is sort of like a ghost town. The dorms get like really lonely and there's almost like just two or three people in the dorms on your floor or like per floor.
The issue affects more than just international students. Those who live out of state or don't have a place to travel to over break are also affected. The International Student Advisory Board has a change.org petition circulating, asking U of I to provide no additional cost housing and meal services during breaks. The group did a comparative analysis of other universities and found several campuses with better break housing options. The University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, keeps residence halls open over fall, Thanksgiving, and spring breaks. Only between semesters, like during winter break, does university housing come at an additional cost. Dan Wright oversees campus housing at the University of Michigan. He says providing that option to stay on campus is part of Michigan's core values as a large public university.
Our students may not be able to really thrive if they have instability, even for a couple of weeks throughout those periods. And again, especially in the middle of a semester where students are really busy and again, have to navigate, again, the closure of a residence hall in between those periods would be really challenging.
Chris Axman-Barker is spokesman for U of I's university housing. He says it's likely that schools that offer no additional cost housing lump the cost of break housing into the total fee that's charged to all students who live on campus. He says the biggest barrier to providing no additional cost housing here is the staffing logistics. There aren't many people interested in working over break.
We want to make sure that as many staff as possible are able to do what they want with their holidays. That's also very important to us. As you would imagine, most people want to go home to their own families.
He says U of I has worked hard to keep break housing rates as low as possible. He explained that the closure of dining hall facilities during breaks was due to a lack of demand. With regard to the student petition, he says university housing welcomes the conversation and appreciates the feedback. Nakia Brown is an associate director from LAS International Programs who endorses the petition. In response to university housing, she said in a statement that international students already pay much more for their education compared to domestic students. adding extra fees for break housing would only widen the equity gap between the two groups. Ashrita Mohanty is a board member of the International Student Advisory Board and an international undergrad junior. She wants people to understand that this lack of break housing and meals is a huge problem.
I think one of the most common feelings that every international student can relate to is entering campus with their life packed into three suitcases, heavily jet lagged, and wanting to figure everything out immediately. And the feeling when you're in campus, when you're overwhelmed with everything, it's unparalleled to anything else. And it's so difficult figuring out things like break housing.
Mohanty says the next steps for the petition include looking for endorsements from international student groups and other departments to represent more voices and perspectives. I'm Adeline Moy, IPM News.
A trip to a museum ended up charting a new course for a woman who was inspired by something she saw there. She talked about her journey during a presentation at Western Illinois University in Macomb, and she spoke with Rich Egger.
Tara Roberts moved to Washington, D.C. around 8 years ago to work for a nonprofit. It was a good job, but she wanted to do more around the issue of race. And then someone gave her a ticket to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. She went, even though she's not much of one for visiting museums.
And I saw a picture there that completely altered my world. It was a picture of a group of primarily Black women in wetsuits on a boat. I had never seen a group of Black women in wetsuits on a boat before.
Roberts says the picture struck a chord. She saw women who looked like her and were leading an adventurous life.
And I didn't know that that was possible before. And it really touched me.
Roberts ended up leaving her job so she could follow the women who were part of the group Diving with a Purpose. They go around the world to document slave shipwrecks. First, though, she had to take a 3-month scuba diving training course. Roberts grew up in Atlanta and had never gone scuba diving. In addition, she had no funding, but she listened to her inner voice and trusted her instincts to follow the women.
I took this leap, and it got me here. So I feel really thankful and grateful.
You just dove in, huh? I know, bad pun.
You can't help it.
But how good of a scuba diver are you now?
Oh, I am not great. I'm a storyteller. These divers have like thousands of dives under their belts. They can do crazy things underwater. I can kind of hang. Like, I don't completely embarrass myself, but I got a long way to go to match them.
As a storyteller and journalist, Roberts started documenting the journey, and she secured a grant from National Geographic to help fund her work. It resulted in the 6-part podcast, Into the Depths.
I descended. The water was this murky blue and green. It felt warm against my skin. Schools of fish were swimming by. Then I saw it. The outline of an anchor.
Roberts also wrote about the experience in the newly released book, Written in the Waters. And Roberts is now a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. She says they'll be doing a part 2 of this project. She cannot go into much detail yet, but says it will honor the past and memorialize the loss of life from the slave trade. She says around 12,000 ships brought Africans to the Americas.
12,000 ships. But I realized when I was growing up that I couldn't tell you the name of a single one of those ships. But I could tell you the name of the Mayflower. I could tell you all about the Titanic. Like, there's an enormous amount of history that's just unexplored and unexamined.
She says they're going to the bottom of the ocean and helping bring this history back into collective human memory. And she says they're not just stories of tragedy, trauma, and death.
There are also stories of resilience and resistance and survival. And there are even stories of laughter and love and joy. It's so much that's a part of this history. So I feel like there is so much work still to be done and so many more stories still to be told about it.
Growing up, Roberts was interested in science fiction, some of which takes readers to the depths of outer space. She never imagined her life would take her to the depths of the Earth's oceans, a journey that landed her on the cover and in the pages of National Geographic magazine. Rich Egger reporting.
We're out of time for Statewide, but join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.